Okay, are we good to go?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Good to see you. Good to see you.
Thanks and welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. Today we have Professor Ilan Pape, who has been extremely unapologetic in his life. Professor, you are a deep historian and scholar of the Nakba, which you say is still an ongoing Nakba. Tell us, just briefly, give us a sense of just how devastating the Nakba was and has been.
Yes. Well, the Nakba was one of the worst crime against humanity that happened after the Second World War, and one which was particularly horrific also because it was denied, not only because of what happened. Within 9 months, in the year of 1948, the pre-Israel forces, the Zionist forces, and later the Israeli army, expelled half of Palestine's population, more than 750,000 people, destroyed half of Palestine's villages, 500 villages out of 1,000, and demolished most of the Palestinian neighborhoods in the and towns in historical Palestine. So, in terms of relative numbers, expulsion of half of population of a whole country didn't happen anywhere else, and the destruction of half of a country's villages is also unprecedented in many ways after the Second World War. And as always with such an expulsions, which are premeditated, planned, systematic, it is inevitable that these kinds of expulsions would be accompanied by acts of massacres or by massacres. What is, I think, more important than anything else are two additional aspects of the Nakba. One is that it was not, as Israeli historians would claim, the result of a war. And they would say, you know, in a war, these things happen. And they also, as you know, Israeli historians blame the Arab leaders and the Palestinian leaders for encouraging the population to leave, which is a lie, a fabrication of history. So that's one aspect that I think adds to our understanding how horrific this was, that it was all planned and part of an ideology. And secondly, which people should be aware of, that the Nakba is also the immediate method used by Israel to erase any presence of Palestine or the Palestinians after the occupation of villages or the expulsion of people. Because even before the end of 1948, Israel turned most of the Palestinian villages either into Jewish settlements or to recreational parks and forests, and the idea was to erase any memory, any kind of indication that there used to be another life there, another culture, another nation, and I think that kind of elimination of the memory, the history that accompanies the physical expulsion and killings makes it one of the worst chapters in the history of the modern Palestine and the modern Middle East as a whole.
Thanks, Professor. I just want to come back. You said two things. You said the one is there's a fabricated lie. You said there's two fabricated lies. The one is that people who are pro-Israel or pro-Zionist narrative say that the Palestinian leaders asked the people to leave, and the second, that this wasn't a war. Tell us more about that. Tell us more about, I mean, I'm sure anyone who's familiar with this, yeah, the very often Zionist narrative that, you know, they were this army fighting against five or six different Arab armies who all, you know, already had, were also in the throngs of becoming independent states. Tell us why that's a fabricated lie.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let's start with the Israeli claim that Arab leaders of neighboring Arab states and leaders of the Palestinian community called upon the population to leave. Any one of us who is a professional historian and went to examine this claim, and it's quite easy to examine it for a period like 1948 when there's no internet, there is no television, there's only one method in which you can try to persuade people to leave, and this is through the radio. And everything in the radio in those days in Palestine was monitored by the BBC. And the BBC has an archive in Reading. And everything that went in the air was recorded there. And we looked at these records. And there's no indication whatsoever for any such call to the Palestinians. And that was the only way. So that request never occurred. This is a lie. And it also, of course, you can examine it logically. Why would people who live in a village for 1,000 years decide suddenly to leave? That doesn't make any sense. It makes much more sense that you have to uproot them by force. So that's one fabrication. The other fabrication is the way Israel and even some supporters, liberal supporters of the Palestinians, still buy into it. They say the Arab world started the war against Israel, and because of that war, Palestinians became refugees. But this is not true. Israel began, or the Zionist movement, began the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in February 1948, before even one Arab soldiers from Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, or Jordan entered Palestine. So before there was any presence of any Arab army in Palestine, the Zionist movement already began massive expulsions of Palestinians.
What was that act in February? What were the acts in February 1948?
It began in February. It was a small operation of expelling few Palestinian villages. But from mid-March, the Zionist movement targeted the urban centers of Palestine. Until the first Arab soldier entered Palestine on the 15th of May 1948, already almost all the population of Jaffa was expelled. Almost all the population of Haifa was expelled. Now, together, these were more than 130,000 people. All the population of Akka was expelled. All the population of Baisan was expelled. All the population of Safad was expelled. So you have five major towns in Palestine that in March and April were totally depopulated by the Zionist forces. You can add to this West Jerusalem with its neighborhoods and 39 villages around it. They were already expelled in April 1948. And what happened was that the mass movement of Palestinian refugees into the Arab capitals put pressure on the Arab governments, who were not very eager to interfere in Palestine, to do something symbolic to stop the ethnic cleansing. So what the Israeli called the Arab-Israeli War was actually an attempt, which came too late and was too little, by neighboring Arab states to try and stop the continued ethnic cleansing of Palestine. I think a particular event that really shook the Arab public opinion was the massacre in Deir Yassin on the 9th of April, 1948. So the news of the massacre, the news and the hundreds of thousands of refugees already coming to Amman, Cairo, Damascus, southern Lebanon, and so on, that what triggered an all-Arab reaction. And as I said, that reaction was not very powerful and came very late. And to this, of course, we can add, and we might talk about it, that Israel also had a tacit agreement with Jordan, which meant that the only Arab army that really mattered in terms of experience and equipment, the Jordanian Arab Legion, was very neutralized because of that political agreement and did not put its share into the all-Arab effort to save the Palestinians, which led to the fall of Lid and Ramle as well. So another two Palestinian towns that were fully depopulated during the Nakba.
Currently, what's going on in Gaza, how would you compare that to the Nakba in terms of devastation, in terms of impact and brutality?
I think what happens now in Gaza, although much of it resembles 1948 or the Nakba of 48, I think it's worse. I think it's far worse. In two levels, it's worse than 48. Ethnic cleansing is a terrible crime, and removing people by force from where they live is immoral and horrific. I think this operation is not about removing people. This is an operation about massively killing them. You know, it's not easy to say that genocide is worse than ethnic cleansing, but it is worse than ethnic cleansing. I say it and always remind people that ethnic cleansing is horrible. So it doesn't shed a positive light on ethnic cleansing. It just says that as horrible as it is, it can be even worse. And the even worse is happening in Gaza. So on one level, it's worse that the actions themselves are not only about uprooting people and not massacres that occur because of the ethnic cleansing, but intentional massacres, intentional killing. Secondly, which we never had in 1948, is the open conversation among chief policymakers in Israel about the need to wipe out Gaza, to wipe out the people of Gaza, to massively kill people using the biblical, which Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu used, using the biblical story on the Amalekites, a people that in the Old Testament, there is a very clear and graphic description how Banu Israel went into what used to be called the land of Canaan and genocided everyone of a people called the Amaleks, the Amalekites. It doesn't matter whether it happened or not. My point is not ancient history. My point is that when Netanyahu says, we will do to the Gaza people what Banu Israel did to the Amalekites, it means that he not only justifies the genocide of Gaza, he almost gives it a religious imperative. These things didn't happen in 48. I mean, this kind of open discourse, conversation about genocide and destruction. And therefore, I think this is a much worse chapter in the history of Palestine. And the Nakba was a horrific chapter, as it is.
Professor Ilan, you were born in Haifa, and you even, when you were a younger person, you even served in the Israeli army during 1973. Mm-hmm. What experiences did you go through as a young person, and even during serving the army, that made you want to say you want to dedicate a big part of your life, almost your entire professional life to a large extent, into studying these events? And just what prompted it? And were you prompted to sort of become a strong dissident of Israeli policies through your studying, or is it something else that prompted it?
Yes. Well, yes, I was. I had a very typical conventional Israeli upbringing until the age when young Israeli men have to go to the army, that it's compulsory service, although, of course, nowadays, younger Israelis, with my opinions, understand that one of the first things they have to do is to refuse to serve in the army. But in those days, we were naive, and we still went to the army. After the service in the army, I began a journey, and it didn't happen in one day. It was a long journey that had different stations that opened my mind about what happened in the history, and later also about the nature of Zionism, and also my attitudes towards the Palestinian liberation struggle and my vision for a liberated Palestine in the future. All that did not happen in one day. I think what was important, first of all, the fact that I wanted to be a professional historian, and I was very much interested in 1948, and I waited for the declassification of documents, both in Israel, Britain, the United Nations, elsewhere. And when I saw the documentation as a doctoral student in Oxford about 1948, I saw evidence that totally challenged everything I knew about 48 and everything my friends knew about 48. It really challenged the Israeli narrative of 48. So that was important. The professional work as an historian played an important role, but that is never enough to make you take the risk of totally challenging your own state's narrative and your own family and friends and academic institutions to take them on. You need more than just the evidence. You need a conviction that morally something is not working. And I could do that because I spent my doctoral years outside of Israel. And I had a great supervisor, the late Albert Hourani, who introduced me to Palestinians. And I met them on equal footing, which I couldn't do in Israel. And learned much more about what happened to
why,
them.
Why couldn't you have met someone with equal footing in Israel? Because of
because in Israel, the educational system until the university level is totally segregated. You don't go to the same schools. You meet Palestinian students in the university, you do. But even then, although it's not officially segregated, the two communities are not working together. So, sadly, there is a power balance, power relations in Israel between Jews and Palestinians. And so conversations are not free from that balance of power, from the fact that you are part of the privileged, dominant society, and they are part of the oppressed minority. But Palestinians outside of Israel were assertive and confident and knew exactly who they are. And I learned so much from them. And when I started to see from the outside, but also from the inside, events such as the first Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, the first Intifada in 1987, and then the second Intifada in 2000, I suddenly saw the connection between what Israel was doing between 1982 to 2000 to what Israel was doing in 1948. I suddenly realized that these are not disconnected events. All these attacks on Palestinians, whether in historical Palestine or in Lebanon, it doesn't matter, or in Jordan or wherever, were motivated, it took me time to understand it, were motivated by a certain ideological point of view and were not happening just out of the blue. And then I was able to ask myself morally, do I share this ideological moral assumptions? The assumption that Palestine belongs only to the Jewish people, the assumption that dehumanizes the Palestinians and does not see them as equal people as the Israeli Jews, and assumptions like that, or that because of what happened to the Jews in Europe, especially because of the Holocaust, nobody should criticize Israel for what it's doing to the Palestinians. All these assumptions that I took for granted as part of my educational trip as a conventional young Israeli, I started as a more mature person to question morally. So it was not just the documents. It was the moral logic that I thought was right. And as a more adult person, I said, no, I cannot accept these moral assumptions. I cannot accept the assumption from that the Palestinians do not belong to Palestine. This is ridiculous. I cannot accept the assumption that because the Jews lived in Palestine 2,000 years ago, they have the right to Palestine. I cannot accept the assumption that Palestinians should live unequal or shouldn't have the same equality in terms of rights wherever they are in historical Palestine. And I definitely didn't share the assumption that because of what the Nazi Germans did to the Jews in Germany and in Europe, this in any case is relevant or justifies what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians. If anything, as someone whose parents came from Germany, my moral assumption was that if this is what the Nazis did to the Jews should be the last people to do anything like it to the Palestinians, rather than saying, okay, this justifies what we're doing. So all this, of course, led to direct clash with my society. People don't like you for saying it. You are treated as a traitor. And eventually I had to leave my university. I was expelled from my university.
We will get there. But just before move on, I mean, there's two journeys that are taking simultaneously. It's one of your continuous conscientization over the situation, and then there's this. Can you give us a year at least, like when when were these documents unclassified and you dive deep
in? Oh yeah, yeah.
That was
Israel, right? Israel and Britain use the same law of declassification, or used to. Now Israel changed the laws, but at the time Israel was following the British law, and the law was such that you open documents after 30 years. So in 1978, both Britain and Israel released documents about 1948.
Were you anticipating these documents as a historian exclusively, or were you certain that you're going to find things in there that is going to be, you know, will turn your perceptions or many people's perceptions upside down? Were you just looking at this?
I came tabula rasa. I came very clean to these documents. I had no target before. I had no idea what I...
There's documents coming out. I want to study this as a scholar.
Yeah, which is very natural. As PhD students, you have to say something nobody said before you. And one of the best way to assure it, you see documents that nobody saw before you. That assures that you have new material. So I thought, yes, I didn't at all expect to find in the documents anything that would challenge my understanding of 48 or of Zionism or Israel and Palestine altogether. No, I was quite surprised. And if you examine my work, you can see that my early books are a bit more cautious because I'm not entirely sure I want to go that way. So I'm using a more careful language when I describe the Israeli actions. And it's only when I felt confident morally, I wrote the book, The Ethnic Cleansing, in 2006. But until 2006, my work already had elements of that, of talking about the fact that Israel committed ethnic cleansing, not only in 48, but continued after 48 and so on. But it took me time to feel that the documents are really challenging fundamentally everything I believed in or I was educated upon.
So now bring us back to you getting expelled from the university, from Haifa University, you said, right?
That's right, yeah.
So what year was that, and what led to that?
Yeah, I think that I have to say that around the year 2000, I was already, my journey was complete. In many ways, namely, I was at peace with myself. I was very sure about my moral position towards Zionism, towards the Palestinian Liberation Movement. I already had great friendships with Palestinians, from the PLO chairman to many others whom I met, and I was already, you know, kind of the end product of someone who was born in Israel, was a Jew, but was definitely a strongly an anti-Zionist Jew, with all the implications of that. And that was a challenge to my university already in 2000, because I made it very clear. I didn't hide it. In fact, I didn't want to hide it. I wanted to persuade other Israelis to go in the same way. I didn't treat it as my own, you know, idea. And the university did not know how to deal with it. And then they began to prepare a big file on me. So all kinds of things I did eventually they thought were enough to expel me. For example, I was one of the first person who was asked, would you support an academic boycott in Israel if Israel continues to disrespect international law? And I said yes.
So this I'm assuming this was in the 90s, considering the file was...
Yeah, in the 90s. Okay. And then came the Tantura case, where a former student, well, it wasn't even a student of mine, but someone I protected because he exposed in a master's degree the massacre in Tantura, which didn't even appear in Palestinian sources, although in oral history it was mentioned, but not in the work of written work of Palestinian historians like Walid Khalidi didn't mention that. That massacre. Well, it was very clear that he found the evidence for that massacre, and he was persecuted by the university and harassed by the university, and a lot of pressure was put on him to change the conclusion of his dissertation. And when he didn't agree, they disqualified him, and I took the lead in protecting him, which was another reason to question my loyalty to the Israeli academia and so on. They forced me to leave, and I went to teach in England in 2006.
What was life like for you in the 80s and 90s as you are, you obviously publishing every now and then, you are most likely upsetting or rubbing against your society because of what you're publishing, what you're stating. Just what's life like in a very sort of lighthearted way, and then also on the more serious way? Like, are you, I mean, you mentioned that you had made friendships by then with the PLO chairman. I'm guessing you made other friendships with other dissidents, with journalists, professors, but you're still a minority. So what's life on the daily? Like, what do you do on the weekends? Yeah. But also just what's that more deep sort of struggle and grappling with yourself during that period like?
I think the worst case, and I never compare what I went through, of course, to the suffering of the Palestinians under occupation or siege. So this is a far worse case than mine. But I think the worst thing for someone who is publicly descending as a professional historian in Israel is the impact, first of all, on your family, if you have small children, as I had at the time. Because what is so unique about Israel that if you are a dissident Palestinian voice in Israel, you will be harassed by the institutions, by the Secret Service, by the police. You know, these will be your tormentors. If you're an Israeli Jew who is descending, it is a society that would do it. It would be your neighbors. It would be your university. The threats would come from the people, not from the institutions. So you get a lot of death threats. And every now and then, the politicians add to this. For instance, the Minister of Education demanded from the university to expel me. A famous broadcaster said people like me don't have the right to live. And that, of course, immediately impacts people. Luckily, nothing terrible physically happened to me, and I'm very fortunate in that. But it was not that far from that, and so life was difficult, especially if you have a family. I think individually you can always take it. In fact, it strengthens you. It makes you even more more convinced that you are right. If they didn't have any counter arguments, they wanted to silence you. I mean, it was much more difficult for me if they had proper counter-argument. If they really debated me, probably it would have been more difficult. But I understood that if they don't want to debate me, if they just want to silence me, it means that they don't have a counter-argument, which means that probably my argument is right, but they don't like it. I mean, they don't like the message, and therefore they don't like the messenger. There were some light, of course, things like that. People were sending horrible things that they did in the toilet in the mail to us at home. And we never opened these envelopes, and we didn't understand why the house was stinking for so many, many days until we understood that people went to this level of show. I have to say that I was disappointed by the fact that so very few members of the Israeli academia stood by me. That was my biggest surprise. I thought that, and I didn't even ask them to share my views, but you know, just.
But do you mean from a point of view of academic freedom, or do you mean from a point of view?
From point of academic freedom. Okay. But say, you cannot expel someone because you don't like the history that he's writing. That's ridiculous. You don't do it in a country that pretends to be a democracy, or an academia that's supposed. But of course, Israel is not a democracy, and therefore they were. By the way, some of them agreed with me, but they were afraid of expressing this support. So it was not easy. But again, I'm compared to the real victims of Israel. One should keep it in perspective.
Absolutely,
right. One should not make too much out of it. It never led to one moment of hesitation that I was not doing the right thing. I mean, this, I knew from the very beginning that I can withstand this attack. And if I can't teach in Israel, I will teach in England. If I can't teach in England, I will teach, I don't know, somewhere else. But that was the less of my worries. The worries was, you know, when you have small children and so on, you kind of cast on them the responsibility for something they haven't done yet.
Absolutely.
Yes.
The thing is, you obviously, you grew up in a society that where everything was kind of very veiled. And I mean, really speaking openly, or even trying to have a conception of what the reality may have been like in 1948 and after that was almost non-existent. And so you've always lived in a cagey society as long as you've lived in Israel, and even now you operate in a field consistently where you're dealing with sort of Israeli talking points and correcting historical narratives. Absolutely. Have you seen over, I mean, from the first time that you could actually conceive of this as a child, how have you seen the society moving? Is it becoming more radical? Are the elements becoming more radical and more unradical? Are people speaking about things more openly now, but they're just defiant or more racist overtly? How has it actually changed the temperature? I mean, on the whole, but also especially since the year 2000. But first, answer it more broadly.
Yeah. I think something has changed in it, Israeli Jewish society. I think the first generation of those who came to Israel in 1948 or before that were part of the Jewish community and came from Europe and also later a bit from the Arab world, the first generation, before they were put into the Zionist educational system. These were people who had some moral worries about what was going on. I think it was a generation that understood that something was not right there, but on the other hand, felt they have no many other options and so on. But I think they left a little bit of hope for a different kind of an attitude by the Jewish society towards Palestine, the Palestinians, and so on. However, the educational system that Israel built made sure that the next generation, through the socialization of the army, the media, the academia, the educational system, became far more racist than the previous generation. You can see it also among the Arab Jews, you know, the Jews who came from Arab countries. The first generation was not hostile to the Palestinians at all. But the new generation, that when they were taken out of their families into the Israeli educational system and indoctrinated and became more racist sometimes even than the European Jews, as you know, towards the Palestinians. So the society gradually, all the time, it was moving more towards even a more racist, a more inflexible position. So unlike many other observers of Israel, I said that I was not surprised about what happened in 2000 when the whole political system of Israel shifted to the right. And later on, when all these marginal messianic groups that was born in the settlements became now major forces in Israel. I said that my only surprise was that it took so long for that to happen. In my articles in the early 90s, I warned by examining the Israeli socialization processes. I mean, what are the younger generation is being taught, is being educated about? I said, this kind of system would produce Jews in Israel who are racist, messianic, and endanger not only the Palestinian, but the Middle East as a whole, because they will be part of a state that would have powerful military weapons, even nuclear capacity. So it's not a joke, you know, when people with such a mindset it's like you're giving a child a fast car. They don't only endanger themselves, they endanger everyone else in the traffic.
And what about the dissenting voice inside of Israel? I mean, I say dissenting I just mean opposition to the
together.
Government. I mean dissenting as in, you know, very morally upset about what's occurring
I think that there was always a group of very brave anti-Zionist Jews from the very beginning of the Zionist project in Palestine, even in the Jewish community, definitely in the beginning of the State of Israel. But they were always very, very small and outnumbered and made no impact on the public discourse and so on. One of the reasons that this anti-Zionist group never grew or extended was the very weird phenomenon that you can call the Zionist left or the liberal Zionism. There was this phenomenon of people who supposedly were believing in human rights, socialism or liberalism or humanism, right? But thought that this does not contradict the Zionist objectives. And for a while, the world said, yes, it's wonderful that you are like this. So they gave them support. And that created there was a way of kind of silencing the anti-Zionists, people who were looked at as extreme because they were not adopting this impossible idea of a liberal Zionist or a left Zionist. I think nowadays in Israel, there's hardly any left Zionism. I think people in Israel realize that you cannot be a liberal occupier, you know, a socialist, ethnic cleanser, and so on. It doesn't work. I think in the Israeli civil society, among the young generation, there is the beginning of a new wave of dissenting voices who refuse to go to the army, who are willing to think of a different vision for the future. I don't want to exaggerate the numbers. They're not powerful enough to cause any change from within. But we should draw some hope from the fact that they exist, because I think if at all we succeed in ending the Zionist regime, which I think we should, we want a hope for everyone, not just for the Palestinians, but also for the Jews who live there and so on. So I think it's important to understand that not every person who defines himself as a Jew in Israel think in the same way. Unfortunately, the vast majority do. And that's why we have this problem. If anybody says to us, oh, we should wait for a change within Israel and then things would get better. No, a change from within Israel would not be the first thing that would happen. This would be the last thing that would happen if we want to change the reality on the ground.
Okay, just moving ahead to the present, to the Israeli state's response to October 7th. When this began, did you expect the response to be as brutal and as systematic as it has been?
No. I was surprised by the level of ruthlessness and cruelty of the Israelis. I mean, I expected a very brutal reaction on the model of the previous four Israeli attacks on Gaza, something, namely, mainly a short period of bombardment from the air and so on. Again, a very ugly and inhuman reaction, but not such a genocidal reaction. But later on, you know, when I analyzed it a bit more calmly, I thought that it's actually not surprising.
Share that analysis with us.
Yeah, because I said, you know, when it comes, Israel has three major Palestinian problems, if you want, as far as the Jewish state is concerned. One is the Palestinian citizens in Israel, and they solved the problem in 2018 with an apartheid law, the nationality law, when they explained to the Palestinians in Israel, Israel would never recognize you as a nation. You can be Muslims, you can be Christians, you can be Druze, and you can speak Arabic. We have nothing against it, but you're not Palestinians. That's the Israeli nationality law. Then there's the problem of the Palestinians in the West Bank. Israel solved it by extensive Jewish settlements in the West Bank, creating pressure on the population to leave areas which Israel wants to resettle Jews there, like Jordan Valley, Masaf Yiriata in the south of Hebron, and created this idea of the PA, areas A, B, and C. And most Israeli generals will tell you it's working. It's working. It's not the best, but it's not bad to have area A, B, and C, and the PA helping us with security issues and doesn't endanger us. The problem was Gaza. What do you do with Gaza? They try to impose the Oslo Agreement on Gaza as well, but it didn't work. It didn't work because the number of Jewish settlers was small, and the resistance in Gaza did not go along with the Oslo logic of accepting living in a huge open prison, and people voted democratically for this rejection in Gaza, and Israel punished Gaza with, you know, with the siege and so on. The resistance reacted to this. Gaza is, from an Israeli perspective, was insoluble compared to West Bank and so on. So they suddenly saw the 7th of October as an opportunity to get rid of Gaza. And it doesn't really matter whether it's the so-called pragmatic Israelis, like Benjamin Gantz, who hope that many Palestinians would leave Gaza. It doesn't talk about genocide, or those who talk about genocide. It doesn't matter. The idea is that you sort of wipe out Gaza as a problem for Israel. And in order to achieve that, you can only achieve it on the level of ruthlessness, cruelty, and dehumanization like we have seen since the 7th of October until today.
What do you think happens now? I mean, it seems like the international community outside of the UK and the US have actually been strongly against this war. I mean, there's been a few exceptions in Europe as well. Over the last sort of 2 to 3 weeks, it seems like the language of the UK and the US is changing slightly. It's still nothing substantive. But I mean, they've basically given an emphasis and you know, are complicit in what's occurring to a large extent. But I mean, what happens now? I mean, are the Palestinians going to be hunkered down in Rafah for a long time? Are they going to be pushed down into Egypt? Will this become more regional? What do you expect to happen?
Yeah, I think much depends on the internal politics, first of all, of the Israeli government, because you have two voices there. You have the voice that can be called more pragmatic, that would try and do what Israel always did before, which is to talk the language that America and the Europeans want them to talk, but not do what they are asked to do, or find ways to hide what they are doing. They will say the war is over, but they will continue to hunt down people. Of course, there is also a possibility, because you have a different kind of Israeli politicians on the second group, people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, the religious Zionists, which are not marginal, they are powerful people. They would want to bring back Jewish settlers into the Gaza Strip, expel by force massively Palestinians, hoping that the Egyptians would be happy to build the buffer zone that they're talking about, kind of a refugee city next to Gaza on the other side of Rafah. However you look at it, we have to say two things about it. Although the Israelis are very powerful now in Gaza, and it seems nobody can stop him, despite, you know, that the Hamas still resists and so on, it seems that they have the power to continue to demolish, to expel and so on. By brackets, by the way, not caring really about the future of the hostages anymore. It doesn't seem to be a concern to them anymore, although they say it is. They don't act as if it is. But I think what is really the big question to me is not so much, I understand what Israel is going to do, but if you ask me what is going to happen, I don't think it depends only on Israel. Would the Palestinians in the West Bank continue to remain silent if this continues? Would the Hezbollah in the North continue with a very limited kind of approach that it adopted since the 7th of October? Would the Arab states, especially Egypt, would be able to navigate in such a way that does not seem to be complicit with all of this? I must tell you, I don't have many hopes for the West as being a constructive actor here, or that they would put a real pressure on Israel to stop. As I said, the language would be of pressure, but I don't think the actions would be. This is for the short term. By the way, I want to tell you that I think in the long term, what happened would impact the governments also of the West, of the Arab world, of the Muslim world. I think that the Israelis don't understand that their relative success in the next year or a half to do whatever they want in Gaza with this horrific consequences to the people of Gaza, and men, so few of us have any way of stopping it, that what they're going to do there in a year and a half would bring later on to their downfall. That later on, this would be proven to be a period, as I said in some places, as the beginning of the end of the Zionist project. And I think in the longer run, that means that Israel would lose its international legitimacy. It's already using its social cohesion from within. It means that the world around them is not going to talk just about normalization with them. It would be too difficult to talk about normalization after what they're doing and will do. This is not, by the way, a scenario I hope for. I don't want to see more Palestinian deaths in order to see the end of the occupation and the oppression. So don't mistake, it's not my proposal. I wish we could skip the next year and a half, but I'm very afraid about the next year and a half.
You mentioned a year and a half, and they could possibly be some sort of turnaround after year and a half. I mean, don't you think even that maybe is a bit of wishful thinking?
You mean it could be longer?
It's not just it could be longer. I mean I do see that you know, it's not sustainable to just continue being a brutal occupier and ethnic cleanser.
That's right.
But I mean, I think in 1948, very few people maybe thought that this would be an ongoing Nakba for 76 years. In 67, I'm sure, you know, many Palestinian people who were just freshly occupied assumed after 5, 10, maybe 6 months, and of not that 5 or 10 years. So I mean, this even then it may be wishful thinking. I mean, very tragic.
No, I tell you why not. I tell you why not. I'm quite confident, and actually I'm confident on this not just as an activist. I'm confident it as a scholar who observes Israel and Palestine for more than 45 years. I really think this is a different situation. I really think that there are clear indications, were not there in 48, clear indication that Israel is coming to an end. And these indications have to do with the lack of social cohesion inside Israel. It sounds like a soft word, the lack of social cohesion.
No, yes.
It's a very serious issue. An economic explosion. Israel is going through an economic crisis that, unlike in the past, it would be very difficult to get out of it. The international scene is very different from 48. Civil societies, governments in the global south have positions they never had in 1948. And you know what is incredible, and Israelis don't take into account, that even someone like Donald Trump, who probably would win, unfortunately, the elections in America, people like him, it doesn't have to be him necessarily, but the kind of Republican mindset that he represents in the United States, begin to see Israel as a liability and not an asset. From an imperialist American position, not because they believe in the rights of the Palestinians to freedom or liberation, because it's not a profitable relationship anymore. All these things together, by themselves, each of these factors is not enough to change the reality. But when they are happening in a parallel way, they create a disintegration, they create a collapse. By the way, a collapse of a state or of a project like Zionism can also be a very bad thing, not always a good thing, because it depends very much what would replace it. Because it will create a vacuum. It will create a void. And the question is, are the Palestinian National Movement, for instance, ready to... Would you say that today the Palestinian National Movement is ready for taking over Palestine? I would say no. I would say no. It's disunited. It doesn't have a proper organization. It needs to... And I don't blame them. They don't think about the future. They think about tomorrow, how to survive. But Palestinians would have to... I don't know, build a new PLO or something else. They would, all the Palestinian organizations, including the Hamas and Islamic Jihad, would have to be part of the of one organization. You cannot have this fragmentation and this unity, because that is not an organization that will be able to take over, even if these processes of disintegration would unfold. So there's a lot of work for everyone. But it's not easy to convince people to be involved in this, because now the feeling is the only thing which, and rightly so in a way, the only thing important now is to stop the genocide. But for some people, it is also necessary to think about beyond that, because these processes can happen very slowly at the beginning, but then they become very quick, you know, as happened in the Soviet Union, in Iran, in South Vietnam. In these places, suddenly it collapses. So I think that is also, it's an optimistic vision in the sense that it offers a scenario of a liberated Palestine equal for everyone in it. But it's also a worrying one, because it could be a chaos that continues for a very long time.
Professor Ilan Pepe, thank you so much for your time today. It was a really nice and rich conversation. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me in the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.